Hello, everybody. Welcome to the first episode of the Regiment Chronicles. I'm Grayson, and today I'm joined by Casey.
Hi there.
And Gabe.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about space today. Pretty big topic, but we've got some interesting things that we want to talk about. First up is the recent fusion discovery and the recent breakthrough that they had in producing more energy than actually went into heating up this pellet. I'm actually not sure what the pellet was made out of, but they produce more energy than they put in, which is a really big milestone. And what I wanted to talk about was the impact of that fusion on the future of space travel. So do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Well, so you're thinking specifically on the use in like spaceships and space
right, travel, yes, space and then like the correct? Future of colonization. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if the technology can get refined and improved upon to the point where it can be used in that scenario, then I think it could be very useful.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's one of those energies that it's very long lasting. So if we have, you know, a Mars colony or a moon colony, it's going to be something that we can supply it with and kind of leave it alone for a little bit and not have to worry about energy, which I think is a big worry right now for a lot of future missions.
True. Do you know how big their test was? Like how, like scale? Was it like a large?
It was definitely very small. I know that the pellet you could hold between your two, like your thumb and your pointer. So it was very small, but an incredible amount of energy had to go in. For the size of the pellet and yeah. More energy came out, which is a really impressive feat, I think.
It is. So, yeah, but if it were to be implemented on spacefaring vessels, it would, I mean, obviously there's the whole issue of the rest of the space vessel. But
right.
As far as energy goes, I mean, you'd have to make it a larger scale because, I mean, I'm assuming, sure, it made a net positive amount of energy. Do you know how much?
I believe whatever the scale of units is, so if we call the units energies, right, let's just call it that, I know one unit of this energies went in and 2.5 came out, or something along those lines, so okay. It was definitely a significant gain.
Well, then I guess, obviously, scale matters, but I think it's
important. You know how big the, like, thing they used to make this happen was?
Well, like I said, the pellet was very small, but of course they have to shoot this super small pellet with, you know, tons of laser energy, which is really...
Yeah, and my question was like, how big was the machine they used to shoot the pellet?
I'm sure it was very large. And the reason
that's something right, to consider.
Right, in terms of like the future, because you have to think if it's if just on that scale it's significantly larger than the pellet and, you know, the lasers and whatever, think about how big it would be on a really large scale, like for a rocket or something like that.
Exactly.
So
yeah, then you have to consider, like, potentially getting something that large into space.
Right.
And then eventually a moon base or something like that. And right now we're not using anything like space shuttles or anything like that. So it'd be a very complicated process. At least right now, to get that
right.
Current technologies, it'd be doable. It just would not be easy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think if you were to use the technology, a better starting use of it would be in like rovers and drones, because obviously you could send them to planets and not have to worry about, you know, their energy necessarily as much. Obviously, solar panels exist, but if you were to send them to further out planets with less, you know, solar energy reaching them, it could be a better way to power those drones. Plus, I mean, I guess this totally depends on the sustainability of the energy source, but it could last longer.
Yeah, I think so. Because I think really the only fuel that you need for a fusion reaction is either tritium or deuterium. And those are both... forms of hydrogen. So, you know, ultimately your byproduct would really just be, you know, nothing pollutant, nothing significant. And then I think even with a small amount of whatever the you know, whether you're using tritium or deuterium, I think you only need a small amount for, you know, a large percentage of energy to be yielded.
And now here's an interesting rhetorical question. If produces energy, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that that same energy it produces can be funneled back into the same reaction to make more energy in some fashion, which would mean that I think it would probably be an exponential growth of energy output, assuming you had the enough.
I'm not sure.
Your tritium.
Right. I know what you mean.
So, I mean, I would assume if it produces energy, I mean, you might have to change its form if they shot it in lasers and it comes out as whatever.
Well, I think what what you're saying, what it would look like in like a real scale would be like the fusion reaction is going off. You're putting in the product and then let's say you're getting out. I think some of the product of fusion is actually water. So if you got water out of the reaction, then you'd do things with the water and eventually it would be broken down into the same ingredients that you put in the beginning. And that might be the cycle. But we were talking about the moon here for a second, and I think that brings me to the next topic of the podcast, which is the Artemis program and our recent launch and successful, I believe, mission of Artemis 1, which was the uncrewed test of the first flight for the Artemis program. And the goal of this program here, I'm reading from NASA, is was to place Orion, which is the capsule, in a lunar orbit and then return it to Earth. And it's using kind of or implementing some of the boosters that I think NASA plans to use in the future Artemis programs, because as we start to get into 2024, 2025, you'll start to see Artemis 2 and 3, and 2024 will actually be the first crewed mission, and they will not do significant testing on the moon, but I believe they will test in Earth's orbit, and then eventually the moon orbit, and as we start to get into 2027 and beyond, I think we'll start to see crewed landings on the moon, which is really a cool thing.
I mean, yeah, it's been a long time since anyone's been to the moon, though, so it's still not an exact science.
Right.
So,
and I think it's pretty amazing that we actually got there.
When was the last human that's been on the moon?
It's been a long time. It's probably the 70s.
Yeah, it hasn't been any time within our lifetime.
Yes, correct. Yeah, and I think, let's see here, the last person to walk on the moon.
December 1972.
Yeah, oh, December 11th. So that just shows
Apollo 17 mission.
Right. And that program was a lot of the things that I... in kind of my research of Artemis has shown is that it's kind of not a reincarnation, but it's definitely a picking up where we left off of the Apollo program. So it's really interesting that we're getting back into that. And one thing I want to ask you two is what your opinion is on kind of like private sector. We think about SpaceX, we think about Elon Musk, and their place in the future of exploration, for instance, Mars. And how that will play out.
I think personally, I mean, obviously there's a whole lot attached to these corporations, but I think they have a lot more freedom in a sense than federal governments and from those sorts of large authorities, because, you know, they're not swamped with all that. Their entire purpose is that furthering of, you know, space missions and
funding caps or anything.
Well, I mean,
there's personal
funding caps. Right, personal funding caps, but NASA only gets a certain, you know, budget.
No government funding cap necessarily, aside from you know, grants.
When they've agreed to build something for NASA, there's generally a funding cap. Like when SpaceX was doing their vertical landing thing, they were doing it for an increase in their government funding cap.
Got it.
Like that that was like their entire purpose behind that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that we kind of not forget, but I think it's important to kind of give NASA the credit. I think of course people give it credit, but Like, one statistic that I read earlier, or kind of piece of information, was that the majority of the, you know, kind of science and technology that's used for rockets are actually patented by NASA. So, like, when SpaceX is doing, you know, simple boostering or, you know, using fuel or mixing that, a lot of those patents actually have come from, you know, they've come from NASA, and that's kind of interesting that they've allowed that.
Well, I mean, yeah, NASA's goal, though, isn't to, you know, like, make money or something.
Right,
it's
right.
It is simply to further space exploration as a whole, so I wouldn't right. expect them to be a particularly greedy organization.
No.
I mean, yeah, they require a lot of money, but that's not really their choice.
Right.
Right? Like, space exploration is expensive, and that's just kind of how it is.
Yeah, no, that's... And it'll be that way... You know, ultimately, until we start to get a steady stream, and that's kind of another topic, is asteroid mining. I think that, you know, when you start to get private sector interested in terms of competition, that's when you really start to get, you know, discoveries and things. You know, we saw that like, you know, the Cold War, and that wasn't competition to private sector, but it just shows you how competition can really fuel that kind of, you know, desire to go further.
No, yeah, everything in history that I know of has benefited right. from competition, whether it's friendly or not, right?
Right.
I mean, competition fuels innovation.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
but I think with your topic of asteroid mining, you just said, I think it also is, it would have to be regulated still, because it would totally wreck economy and... Yep. all of these things if it was an unregulated source of, you know, precious metals, minerals, all of those things.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it could accidentally create a monopoly if one space organization, like a private one, has more access to something like that than any other.
Right.
Well, and I mean, not to steer this in the direction of economics, but kind of. I mean, if you, for example, gold on Earth, it's pretty rare. Yet if we found an asteroid that's full of gold, the entire
right.
you know, price of that changes, the entire, like, all of supply and demand chains change, and that affects everything.
Right.
And so having access to asteroid mining, I don't know how it would be done if it has to be regulated to the point right. where, like, you can only mine so much, you can only,
right. Right.
like, that kind of thing, or how prices are regulated, but private sector would have to be managed for that. So that it doesn't get out of hand.
Well, one thing I found interesting is, I don't know if you're aware of the Chinese landing on the dark side of the moon, but one of the things that I had kind of been thinking about recently is the strategy behind that decision. You know, the dark side of the moon, in many ways, is not important, or not as important as having the ability to, you know, view the Earth and kind of have... you know, have technology on the light side of the moon. However, what the dark side of the moon has is asteroid impacts, which are full of kind of ore deposits and things. And that's something that I didn't think of before, which is that...
That's
you know,
true.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. There are minerals and stuff from asteroids
right.
and comets and whatever that hit the moon. That's a fair point,
so
actually.
It could be kind of a strategic move by China to kind of, you know, start in the beginning stages of asteroid mining, but in a way that would be easier than actually, you know, landing on an asteroid.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair, but also, like, yes, lots of valuable things come from mining asteroids.
Right.
But we really have yet to see how valuable those things can actually be, right?
Right.
Because if we discover how to produce something on Earth that has the same function or
yeah.
even slightly worse function, right. we're going to use that over
yeah.
over asteroid mining.
That's
yeah.
true.
Well, that depends on how easy it is to do asteroid mining. Obviously, right now, we haven't done it. We can't do it easily. It would be a pain. Obviously, it's so many issues.
Right.
For, like, in the future, maybe it's easier and it's actually more efficient to asteroid mine rather than, you know, decimate a planet for our
planet.
Resources, you know. And
right.
if you were to do it on the moon, obviously you get into a different problem of it is much harder to ship those resources back.
Right. I didn't even think about that.
Because,
that's true.
Well, because the moon has a much stronger gravitational pull. You actually have to launch off the moon.
Right.
Which means you'd have to bring more fuel. or whatever, right, rather than being able to simply
than just an asteroid
turn around from an asteroid.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, low that's gravity true. Or whatever.
And I think that's where having a moon base and this kind of the beginning of this Artemis program is really important, is because, you know, if we have a permanent base on the moon that not only teaches us how to do it on other planets, but, you know, our moon is, if you think about, like, you know, people talk about nation relations and they say it's our closest ally. I think in a way the moon is our close, you know, it's our closest ally in that it's, you know, it's right next door. It's, you know, it's not that long to get to. And if we set up a base there, just like what you're talking about, shipping would be so much easier if we had a permanent base there, you know?
True. Oh, yeah, it would make exploration of everything so much easier.
Right.
Right. Because while it's not, like, significantly closer, well, it's not, like, a lot closer to Mars,
right,
it does provide us a checkpoint. And,
right,
and anything
exactly
helps.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, that, so the moon is kind of, you know, it's an ancient body, of course. I think one of the things that I wanted to talk about next was kind of the old ways of using the moon and using stars for navigation and also for other things. One of the things that I was thinking about recently was how much clearer the skies were with no, you know, basically no light pollution in most of the world, and how that affected how people viewed the stars and how they were so extremely important
for
everything.
Also, note with that, I mean, as time evolves, our knowledge evolves.
Right.
And back in, you know, not necessarily even ancient times, but just old, you know, a couple centuries, century and a half ago,
right,
where light pollution was significantly less, or our knowledge was significantly less of space and the cosmos, it seems more reverent in a way, because,
mm-hmm,
you know, unknown and mysterious, don't know what's out there kind of thing.
Right.
But now that we have all of our instruments and telescopes and, you know, we've been out into space to,
right,
some extent, we have more experience with it. It's less...
That's true.
It's less mysterious now, I think, which has an effect.
I mean, I would argue that, yes, certain things are less mysterious, but, I mean,
yeah,
it's
obviously
space.
We don't know everything.
It's space. The more we learn about it, the less we understand about it.
It's true,
right?
Yeah,
and it's,
right.
I can't see that changing, like,
right,
really anytime soon or within like anyone alive now's lifetime, right? Like,
well,
we're not,
it's changed to the point where we're not worshiping the stars anymore.
No, right.
No, but I mean, even during like the Renaissance, those people, like, people then were worshiping,
right,
the stars,
right?
Right. Like, yeah, you don't need to go to them, right, to understand what they are. You don't need to, like, go to it.
No.
You're right. You're right. But it's still some measure of, I mean, we certainly know more than we did then.
Oh, yeah.
That's
so
true.
We know more. Yeah. I'm not disagreeing
and
with that.
And I think you're also totally right. There is so much that we don't know. But I think that just strives for us to learn it rather than...
Yeah, it gives us kind of a
think
a
it's
goal
out of reach.
Right.
Oh, I totally agree with that. It's not out of reach, and, you know, human nature, we're going to want to go learn about it, but it's going to take a lot of time. Like,
mm-hmm,
a lot of time.
A lot of time, and hopefully some of that's in our lifetime. But with that, I think we're reaching the end of our time here. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you on the next installment of the Chronicles of the Regiment. Thanks, guys.
Bye.